port. I had much to do with him. He was in my watch. A negro in a British forecastle is a lonely being. He has no chums. Yet James Waite, afraid of death and making her his accomplice, was an impostor of some character, mastering our compassion, scornful of our sentimentalism, triumphing over our suspicions. But in the book he is nothing. He is merely the center of the ship's collective psychology and the pivot of the action. Yet he, who in the family circle and amongst my friends is familiarly referred to as the nigger, remains very precious to me. For the book written round him is not the sort of thing that can be attempted more than once in a lifetime. It is the book by which, not as a novelist perhaps, but as an artist striving for the utmost sincerity of expression, I am willing to stand or fall. Its pages are the tribute of my unalterable and profound affection for the ships, the seamen, the winds, and the great sea, the moulders of my youth, the companions of the best years of my life. After writing the last words of that book, in the revulsion of feeling before the accomplished task, I understood that I had done with the sea, and that henceforth I had to be a writer. And almost without laying down the pen, I wrote a preface trying to express the spirit in which I was entering on the task of my new life. That preface, on advice which I now think was wrong, was never published with the book. But the late W. E. Henley, who had the courage at that time, 1897, to serialize my nigger in the New Review, judged it worthy to be printed as an afterword at the end of the last installment of the tale. I am glad that this book, which means so much to me, is coming out again, under its proper title of The Nigger of the Narcissus, and under the auspices of my good friends and publishers, Messrs. Doubleday, Page, and Company, into the light of publicity. Half the span of a generation has passed since W. E. Henley, after reading two chapters, sent me a verbal message. Tell Conrad that if the rest is up to the sample, it shall certainly come out in the New Review. The most gratifying recollection of my writer's life. And here is the suppressed preface. 1914, Joseph Conrad. Preface. A work that aspires, however humbly, to the condition of art should carry its justification in every line. And art itself may be defined as a single-minded attempt to render the highest kind of justice to the visible universe by bringing to light the truth, manifold and one, underlying its every aspect. It is an attempt to find in its forms, in its colors, in its lights, in its shadow, in the aspects of matter and in the facts of life, what of each is fundamental, what is enduring and essential, their one illuminating and convincing quality, the very truth of their existence. The artist, then, like the thinker or the scientist, seeks the truth and makes his appeal. Impressed by the aspect of the world, the thinker plunges into ideas, the scientist into facts, whence, presently, emerging, they make their appeal to those qualities of our being that fit us best for the hazardous enterprise of living. They speak authoritatively to our common sense, to our intelligence, to our desire of peace, or to our desire of unrest, not seldom to our prejudices, sometimes to our fears, often to our egoism, but always to our credulity. And their words are heard with reverence, for their concern is with weighty matters, with the cultivation of our minds and the proper care of our bodies, with the attainment of our ambitions, with the perfection of the means and the glorification of our precious aims. It is otherwise with the artist. Confronted by the same enigmatical spectacle, the artist descends within himself, and in that lonely region of stress and strife, if he be deserving and fortunate, he finds the terms of his appeal. His appeal is made to our less obvious capacities, to that part of our nature which, because of the warlike conditions of existence, is necessarily kept out of sight.